quite important, Chairman, going forward. We believe that the figures that the medium-term strategic framework has put on the investment side are here to drive this economy to higher levels in the next 6 years. If you add that the CAPEX program of ESCOM, of Transnet, which are really 20-year programs, we've seen huge economic growth and commercialize this economy up to around 2030, because these institutions were putting money in the economy on infrastructure, in this case energy, which has got huge linkages in manufacturing sector as well as on logistics. We know that companies like Kumba are exploiting resources in the Northern Cape due to demand for iron ore domestically and internationally. So it's a very brilliant picture for the South African economy going forward. However, Chairman, there is a huge area of concern. That is, with this massive expenditure that we see coming from government, is that the monetary policy is responding counter-cyclical, in the sense that the inflation targeting framework, which is a 3 to 6% target, has had an effect. At the moment, it didn't come through because of the lag effect of interest rates. That small and medium enterprises who supply these public investment programs that's coming from our government, that find themselves in squeeze due to high cost of borrowing. This chairman is on the back of a country that has got high levels of poverty, high levels of inequality. At the same time, blacks now coming into the mainstream of the economy and finding themselves being strangled by monetary policy which is counter-cyclical to the investment program of government. And that monetary policy is couched around inflation. If you look, Chairman, around global inflation environment, the left graph you can see that developing countries have experienced rapid decline of inflation. Which low inflation is very good for the poor, because it means that the cost of food, transport, is very affordable. So one is not saying that an inflation targeting framework is bad for us, but my contention this morning is going to be that maybe in periods such as the one that we are under globally, we need some flexibility. So, for example, in China, inflation has accelerated quite rapidly, reaching a 10-year high, in line with how South Africa has done. The main drivers of this economic inflation trend around high cost of energy, as we all are aware. But if you look at this graph, that the steep rise in commodity prices, including oil as well as food prices, are increasing concern on the inflation front globally. The strong growth in global demand has kept oil very, very high, as well as metals, particularly the demand from China. The focus on biofuels generally, particularly in developed countries, where farmers have moved away from producing corn for consumption, but corn for energy, has also contributed to the rising food prices globally. There's also strong demand that has resulted in high levels of capacity utilization. That is in South Africa, whereby our capitalization is about 86% at the moment. Therefore, there's a huge pressure for us to create new capacity, because on current economic growth and on the back of the investment that government has announced in terms of infrastructure, the current capacity cannot sustain an economy growing above 6%. This is overemphasized by the investment in the state of 2010, where a lot of our construction steel is being imported from China, because our local producers cannot meet the pension demand due to underinvestment in capacity. Again, if you look at where the inflation trends are going generally, is that there's a bias now towards higher levels of inflation. If you look at the headline inflation, that's a blue line there. But food is the biggest component globally. So all consumers globally are finding themselves struggling and having to shift their food basket because inflation on for food has risen. But also add inflation for oil, which quite negatively on transport. If you look at emerging markets and developing economies, you can see how much impact the food has had. Because in emerging markets, the food is a huge component, given the fact that the poor spend most of their income on food and transport. So you can see the spiking up. That, you know, here we've got an interesting structural phenomenon as far as inflation is concerned. Also, if you look at the direct impact of food prices inflation, on the world side, food inflation contributed about 26.6% between 2000 and 2006. In the current year, it's about 26.4%. If you look in Africa, there's been a decline because Africa is unevenly developed. A lot of people live below $1 a day. So the hunger is very, very high. So the decline that you see there has been overstated by countries that find themselves, such as Zimbabwe, such as a lot of countries in East Africa, including Uganda, where there's been massive floods due to the rain that they've experienced. And then you add it up with other countries that have had surpluses, particularly in West Africa. So in Africa, generally, food prices have come down due to these contrasting experiences between East and West Africa. If you look at the US food price inflation at producer level, including farm products, that's the blue line there. If you look there, the US also is experiencing a high level of producer price inflation. Really emphasizing my point this morning, that inflation globally is undergoing a huge structural change, that the days of inflation is dead are over. We now in a different period where inflation is here to stay with us for a long time. If you look again at a country which is very latest of Africa, because it's got challenges that South Africa faces, high levels of inequality, we're talking about China now, a big second economy with a lot of people living in rural areas in China, and the first world economy in areas like Shanghai, Beijing, etc., where, you know, it's a first world economy. So China, to an extent, reflects some of the experiences that we see in South Africa. And hence, if you look at the inflation, it's gone up tremendously, very similar to South Africa, partly because of high energy prices as well as producer prices and food prices, which have impacted quite negatively. So when you look at us, we probably must look at us vis-a-vis the US or Europe. Let's look at ourselves vis-a-vis China, because China is going to be a huge factor in our future going forward. Therefore, as we implement policies, that market becomes very relevant, because it's a rich consumer of South African metal products. And recently we saw with the influx of Chinese money to the economy, which was announced last week by the National Bank. If you look at producer inflation in South Africa, we've got a similar pressure of very high input prices, which then are impacting on downstream industries in terms of competitiveness and making sure that we can sustain the high levels of growth that the Minister of Finance was talking about on Tuesday. More encouraging in a way is that if you look at the blue line, is the nominal effective exchange rate of the rent. That is on the left-hand axis, on the right-hand axis in your side. What we've seen is that the rent has strengthened quite nicely, in a way absorbing some of the impact of the imported inflation that was seen coming through our economy. So the story could have been worse, where the currency beyond 7.50 the dollar. So we're being pushed at the moment by really a robust currency, which is very good for imported inflation, but really very bad for our exporters. And this raised a lot of issues concerning the medium-term budget policy statement that the minister talked to on Tuesday, mainly reflecting to competitiveness, particularly a liberalizing trade, because the resiliencies in the global economy, particularly at World Trade Organization, is much more complex than being one of free trade. The older scholars like Adam Smith and many others who are arguing for free trade have yet to see that becoming a reality in the global economy. And as such, there's more politics about how you're dealing with your trade, how you protect your interests, than just liberalizing because an economic theory tells you to. And in theory, if you liberalize, therefore, you will kill those that are not competitive, and the economy will then restructure and move towards a competitiveness. This theoretically sounds very, very well. But in practice, we know all economies, all leaders, look after the national interest. So I would like to really caution about the over-excitement towards the liberalization, that it may not lead to the desired wishes of the Minister of Finance that will lead to more exports or lead to more competitiveness. That has not been the case, at least in our current experience. As I said, grain, which is a huge staple food for the poor in South Africa. The poor at the moment are finding themselves under a lot of pressure, just in terms of gaining access to food. So, if you've got a very high interest rate environment, you've got a very high transport base due to the fact that the state has failed the poor in terms of providing efficient transport. Should then the poor really pay a huge price through borrowing money for survival? So these are the issues that for me, I think need a structural thing in terms of using inflation targets dogmatically because we've reached the upper limit of 6%. Just going on around food as well, you can see here I've got all the components around food. I've got meat products. As you can see, meat products have declined a little bit in the past few months, but milk as well as fat and oil have continued to rise quite strongly in the past. And if you look also on the imported inflation or what South Africa has been importing in the past few months, that the import demand for mineral products has increased by 68% in the previous year, with oil now accounting for close to 15% of all merchandise imports. Over the first 9 months of this year, the value of imported mineral products has already increased by 40%, reflecting the impact of high global oil prices as well as increased domestic demand for fuel. So we are all under pressure in terms of costs. The costs are shooting up quite rapidly. Here I've got basic food prices that I've talked to. As you can see, grain remains quite robust in terms of increases. Meat is risen, but not as fast as grain. And lastly, if you see self-inflation, it's a strong bias towards high food prices, as you experience. With maize continues doubling over the past year due to severe drought conditions as well as the switch towards biofuel in many countries. Given the fact that high prices of products such as maize meal as well as meat products have a huge impact, particularly in terms of the poor, because you know a lot of them consume those, that a lot of them are finding themselves really struggling to meet their needs. Moving on, looking forward, we believe that the expectations from the Treasury that going forward inflation is likely to come down, that is based on what we think and what we're expecting on the current assumption that we're making. But if the piece that I've painted around a structural change in inflation, that we likely to see high levels of inflation for quite a long, long while. Therefore, the target of 6% is going to be breached for a long time. So do we as South Africans continue using interest rates as an instrument to curb that? Or If you look also in terms of what is surprising, that they also are adding huge input costs, particularly to the economy, to manufacturers. We all aware that we have outages in the city, we continue to have outages across the country, and Eskom is asking for an 18% increase so that they can be able to meet their investment expenditure. But the challenge is going to be how much those increases are going to have on the inflation. And we know that they're going to have a huge impact. And at the same time, we need to do that investment. Otherwise, this economy will never grow. So that really supports my argument that structural inflation is here to stay. Therefore, why do we use interest rates as a mechanism to curb inflation? So we've reached 6% ceiling for 6 consecutive months. In September, we are about 6.7%. Food prices increased by 12% in September. Inflation failures are likely to prevail throughout 2007. So core inflation is standing at 5.5%. So really the bias is towards high levels of inflation. Here I'm talking about running costs, transport running costs, I'm talking about food and others. So structurally, you are in a high inflation environment. Chairman, just to move towards conclusion, recently released economic data does not provide immediate comfort for the inflation outlook. So we wonder how optimistic is the minister in terms of the outlook, given the fact that he's seeing growth levels about 4.9% on the GDP this year and about 4.5% next year. We think the inflation is likely to have a huge impact on the investment. Already we've seen some of the investments slowly postponing, also on the belief that the prices that have risen are going to come down over time, because everyone sees that 2010 is around, therefore the state is going to buy anyway. So the temptation to keep prices very, very high. So we see some of the companies saying, maybe let me delay a pitch, maybe it will come right. I don't think that's the right decision. I think the structural changes are happening, so prices are going to remain quite high. So for those manufacturers that are postponing, I think that's the right decision. They should continue investing in buying, because we now see a structural change in the inflation front. Chairman, in conclusion, my argument here, if it hasn't come true, is that the use of inflation targets is very important for South Africa. I'm just mentioning that the 3 to 6% band under global inflation structural changes may be too narrow a band. There is an argument that the minister puts across and the governor that, you know, low inflation is very, very good for the poor. I agree with him. But the reality is that the events, the global events, are beyond our governor and our governor's control. Special changes, I've talked about food, I've talked about energy, I've talked about a lot of other things that are impacting negatively on the special inflation globally. Therefore, Chairman, I want to argue and conclude that if you're going to support our fixed investment program to build new capacity, it's very important that monetary policy and fiscal policy align. Therefore, I will urge the Treasury to look at increasing the target to between 5% and 8%. And secondly, for the Minister of Finance to really emphasize the importance of output growth as well as employment. As we saw last week in the study released by HSRC around employment, that for us to have unemployment by 2014, we need massive investment in various sectors. And therefore, we can only do that if the monetary policy and fiscal policy speak the same language, not the language of the Reserve Bank of using interest rates as a means of curbing inflation, irrespective of the global structural changes we are seeing on the inflation front. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks to me. I'm not too sure. This is very interesting stuff coming out of this presentation. I'm not too sure whether we want to engage with Zoom here or we want to bring in the second and the third, and then we engage with them in the time. Thank you. I mean, let's say on the committee. Because you stay on the bench here at Ungi, the other presenter then will deal with all three of the members of the group, then can you do that?
Okay.
And let me ask then Mr. Domshan to come through.
About revenue numbers and very little, if anything, about policy. And I don't know whether they think perhaps to be limited by the policy statement that comes to steam the byline and the unlike of the main budget in February, and they want to shift the focus there again. But nevertheless, I'll be coming to specifically the policy issues that are not addressed in the immediate term budget policy statement, though it's been said that this statement is not a mini budget, it's about policy. Now, when I look at the immediate term budget policy statement, Chair, I see a number of overriding themes. I think the objectives are still the same. Accelerating economic growth, because that is the key to creating employment, and creating employment in turn is the key to reducing poverty and inequality. But I get the sense from the document as though it says that fiscal policy has basically done its part. There's very little additional that fiscal policy can do to achieve these objectives. It's over to the other policy arms of government now. In terms of policies, but also in terms of better execution, I think it is very necessary that we should be careful in our debate, that we don't put all the emphasis on fiscal policy and monetary policy as though that will solve all our ills. At times I get the feeling that we engage much, much more with those two issues than with other policy issues of a more structural nature that are at times more difficult to deal with, but nevertheless that, to my mind, at the moment, very relevant. Then also I get the feeling that the NCBBS wants to emphasize that the gains in government's financial position must be preserved. The gains that have been made in the past 10 years in terms of reducing budget deficit, in terms of reducing the government debt ratios, and therefore the percentage of regular expenditure that goes towards servicing that debt, and that in terms of continuity, therefore, that I referred to earlier on, that those fiscal ratios were things to watch for the future. Then also the statement emphasizes economic imbalances and the risks that those imbalances might catch up with us and also catch up with the fiscus, and that therefore the emphasis at this point in time should be on the sustainability of the fiscal position. It's generally accepted that if you have a large current account deficit such as we have at the moment, then potentially you're running the risk of a currency crisis. And one of the best ways of countering that risk is to have a sound fiscal position, to have a fiscal surplus, and also to ensure the sustainability of that position. Then also, it's clear from the monetary policy statement that fiscal policy very much wants to support monetary policy. So it implies it accepts, therefore, the objectives of monetary policy, but after all, the inflation targeting framework set by government in general and specifically in the National Treasury, so one would expect that, but it also comes through as a theme, I would say. Now, against that background, those are the five or six items that I'll be talking about briefly: the revised macroeconomic forecast, the revised estimates for the current fiscal year, the revised projections for the next 2 years, the introduction of the structural budget balance, other policy matters, and then just an evaluated comment or two at the end. As far as the macroeconomic forecast is concerned, if you compare the current forecast that we have now to what we were presented with in February at the time of the budget, then, of course, government inflation forecasts have also gone up like that of everybody else. That implies, of course, then higher interest rates. Government don't give their interest rate forecast, they only give their inflation forecast, but naturally I think one would expect, therefore, them also to have elevated their interest rate forecast. Then also the theme of growth being rebalanced, consumption expenditure playing less of a role, investment spending playing more of a role, that's a theme that's been
running for some time, but that will gain further momentum in the next few years. Implying therefore also for investment to drive the economy and all the implications that investment has been taken for the current account balance, it will be very necessary that we discipline consumption expenditure in the economy to create the room for investment spending. Then government has upped the current account deficit quite substantially, I think for many observers, those are quite scary numbers, but they are fortunately quite far into the future, so markets don't tend to discount the current account deficit in 3 years' time, they look at where it is now, and then with that, of course, then lower growth. Now just to look at the numbers, and in the table there I have a column for the February budget, what the government was looking at then, the medium-term budget policy statement forecast now, and I've just compared it to our own forecast, which would give you a sense of how I would judge the credibility of those forecasts. Now, if you look at 2007, you see our own forecast and that in the medium-term budget policy statement are virtually the same. So I don't have anything to comment on that really. If you go to 2008, then it's striking that although the MTBPS also takes into account higher inflation, the level that it sees for inflation next year is lower than what we see. In other words, behind that there must be an assumption that inflation will come down much more rapidly than what we are forecasting. I'm not that pessimistic as Mr. Mondi that we will see inflation above the 6% upper end of the target range for very long. I think by middle of next year, either the third quarter of next year, we'll move below the 6 again. But anyway, as I said, I think we see this coming down more slowly, and therefore I would assume that we would also assume interest rates would come down more slowly than what the Treasury would be assuming in their forecast. And the result is therefore that we see lower growth next year compared to the medium-term budget policy statement. Current account deficit roughly the same, and then going into 2009, still very much the that same trend. But the whole thing jumped. They see inflation coming down more rapidly, therefore interest rates coming down more rapidly, and therefore the economy growth picking up, and the current account deficit is also becoming larger as a result of that. Now, if you look at those forecasts, what does it tell you in terms of background and the implications for policy? I think the statement emphasizes the growing and persistent imbalances in the economy, particularly accelerating inflation and the rising current account deficit. Just want to show you this graph on the inflation side. The blue line shows the CPIX inflation, and the purple line or whatever gives you the line for core inflation, which excludes, amongst other things, fresh produce. Food prices, therefore, to some extent, at the level of fresh products. The point I want to make here is that although, if you look at core inflation, the level is lower than for CPI inflation, the trend is the same. So, you can also exclude energy prices, and we don't have an official number of that, but the Reserve Bank gives us some indication every time that we get in the NBC statements, if you look at inflation excluding food and energy, a lower level but still the same trend, also one of acceleration. So in terms of the monetary policy response, as far as the direction of inflation is concerned, I just want to make the point that if you excluded those two elements, that mostly comes from international influences at this stage, as Mr. Mondi rightly pointed out, you would still come to the same conclusion that you would have tightened policy. And specifically, I just want to respond to the argument that that we shouldn't raise interest rates because food inflation and fuel inflation is beyond the Reserve Bank's control. But then you will have to be consistent in your argument, and you will also have to adopt the selective position in saying that the inflation falls because of low inflation in food and in energy, we should not follow it with the downwards of your interest rate policy. And when we were looking at CPI's inflation between 3.5% a year or two ago, that said food inflation was between 1-2%, which was unsustainable. If we'd not followed food inflation down, then we would have not reduced interest rates to the same extent that we could have been done, and then also we would not have had to raise it to the extent that we've now had to raise it. So the Reserve Bank is consistent. They're asymmetrical in what they're doing. And I think we suggest accept that point if we want to criticize the policy on that specific aspect. Then, the current account deficit, of course, as you know, we're above 6%, almost 7% of GDP, showing that there's excess demand in the economy compared to what the economy can produce. And just on that point, the sustainability of the deficit, of course, depends very much on what happens internationally, because we've been getting the capital to finance the deficit, but the question is whether we will continue to get that capital. The international situation will always be uncertain, but I think the statement is correct in saying that at the moment the uncertainty is even higher than what it usually is because of the international financial crisis started with the subprime problems in the US. Now, what we've seen, as you can see, for example, here from the IMF forecast that's been released recently, all forecasters are forecasting that economic growth next year will slow down. You can see here the IMF, which is the green columns there, the white columns, seeing growth coming down from 5.2% this year to 4.8% next year. But the fact of the matter is, they themselves argue very strongly that the risk up to the downside. I don't think anybody really has a complete grip as to how this whole thing is going to play out. And the way I see it, it's a two-year story. It's not something that's going to be resolved in the next month or two. It's a two-year story, and therefore there's still huge risks lying ahead. Along with that comes also, unfortunately, at the same time, as growth has been slowing down, also higher inflation, particularly you can see there in the emerging world, where the average inflation rate is above 5 at this stage, and also a forecast for next year. Growth is very important for capital flows to emerging markets. The graph here illustrates the numbers from the Institute for International Finance. You can see the acceleration in capital flows to emerging markets since 2004 in particular, and we share in that. And if growth globally slows down, then it's not illogical to come to the conclusion that you will see commodity prices, of course, moving down, but then the capital flows also slowing down. If capital flows slow down, then specifically countries with current account deficits are first in line to be in it. And just comparing our situation, I'm using IMF numbers again, compared to other important countries, the so-called BRICS, plus a few others. And you can see we sort of stand out there. There are only a few countries, South Africa, Turkey, and to some extent Hungary also, in our league, in our peer group, that has this kind of deficit. So you get this ongoing perception that countries with high current account deficits are the most at risk. Sorry, I'm going the wrong way now here again. So, what are the implications of this international uncertainty regarding the risk that we're taking? Caution is required. Monetary policy must be supported. Tighter fiscal policy would actually reduce the need for higher interest rates and not the other way around. But then I must ask, if fiscal is taking that decision, why did we have the huge tax relief for individuals that we've seen in recent years? I recall that in my own commentary earlier this year on the February budget, I thought that was inappropriate at that stage. Even going back to last year, in my own comments before the budget, I said that I think the surplus would be in order. But we had this huge tax relief that's also contributed by increasing disposable income to the consumption and debt explosion that we've seen. I can't help but wonder whether perhaps that was a decision that was taken not by the National Treasury, but by government at large. But the emphasis, therefore, should rather be on structural issues in the economy, structural reform in the economy at this stage, and fiscal and monetary policy. Now, In response to these risks and uncertainties, government has now introduced, or the state has introduced, the concept of the structural budget balance. And then we're joining the banks of other countries that also have similar arrangements, particularly commodity exporting countries where government lending is sensitive to commodity exchange. So I think it was very necessary, and I think I want to congratulate the Treasury on doing that. They're emphasizing the fact that high commodity prices and the improvement in the terms of trade has come with that, has given us a bit of a windfall. Also with that, of course, the strong inflow of capital that we've seen, and just a few graphs to illustrate that, and you can see the commodity price cycle with strong move upwards in recent years. And by the way, it shows you, if you look at different categories, our food prices in particular been very strong recently. The improvement in the terms of trade since roughly about 2000, reversing the decline in trade of about 15 years since then, and then the portfolio investment inflows that we've seen, you can see how that picked up in 2004, so that's our part of the increased flow to emerging markets that I pointed out earlier. Now, the point is therefore, from the Treasury perspective, the economy is growing above its potential, which implies revenue growth is above potential, and that we should therefore be careful in spending that excess. Sustainability therefore requires conservatism, and therefore we get the structure of budget balance adjusted for the economic cycle. But I must say that in my view it's a soft concept. It's not hard numbers in the same sense as the normal budget numbers. It depends on various assumptions and things. It's difficult at times to separate cyclical and structural change. And specifically, for example, when you talk about the terms of trade, as I said, we've had an upward trend since 2000 after a 15-year downward trend. Now, this upward trend, how much of it is cyclical? How much of it is structural? I'm inclined to think that at least part of it is structural because of the change that we've seen in the mix of global economic activity towards emerging market countries with a higher commodity intensity in terms of the GDP growth. So, Treasury says they look at the deviation from the long-term trend in the terms of trade, but I would argue looking at this graph is quite critical to say what the long-term trend actually was. Then also, measuring potential outputs. Treasury comes out with 4.6%, that's a number very close, same, although the Reserve Bank should become up about 4.5%. But in the first place, the methodology is used, it's a recognized methodology, but it's a rather mechanical way of doing it. They do allow for the fact that potential growth will could increase to 5% by 2010. But the fact of the matter is that potential output is a moving target, it's a very difficult thing to pinpoint, and that therefore you can never quite be sure exactly what the potential growth of the economy is. So what I want to say in conclusion therefore is welcome additional information that we have, we should keep it in mind, but don't look at the numbers, rather look at the principles behind bear that in mind. Just coming to the fiscal numbers themselves, Chair, get back more to the budget. I don't want to say much about this year. All that the only things that the upward revision to growth tax revenue, additional 9.5 billion, is more than what most people expected. I assume that that means that Treasury, or perhaps SARP specifically, moving to a more accurate assessment in terms of its revenue projections. On the expenditure side, we've also seen upward revisions, but what strikes me there that almost half of that upward revision is money that's allocated to various public corporations, and that is something that I will return to later. Revised projections for the next 3 years. It's things that stand out to me, the projected growth in revenue, being increased in spite of reduced growth forecast. the next graph, the table shows you what I mean. If you look there at the second line in the table, at the time of the February budget, the scorecast that revenue would increase by 8.6% next year and 8.5% year after that. That's now been up to 11.4% and 10.3%. And there, I must say, I'm asking myself, is that perhaps something to do with the introduction of the structural balance? That encourages government to be more bold, instead of being conservative, I mean, perhaps over-conservative in its revenue forecast, rather give the forecast, the base forecast, and counter that thing by saying, okay, how much of this is of a non-permanent nature, is of a cyclical nature, by looking at the structural budget balance. Expenditure is quite upwards, but by the case, so we have budget surpluses now, over the next 3 years, over each and every year, the bottom line there. And I just want to emphasize that those were achieved through the division in the revenue numbers, and not by doing anything as far as, not by lowering expenditure to any extent. So along with the budget surpluses comes rising cash balances. Cash balances is going to see the 100 million rand very soon. I also get the impression from the statement that once discouraged expectation of tax relief, with which I don't have a problem. Just two alerts that I want to point out there. One is the government wage bill. In real terms, the wage bill increased by 1.8% per year from 2001 to 2006, and the statement tells us that it will increase by 4.5% per year in real terms from 2006 to 2010. Because I think it's necessary to watch that. It's part of the delivery responsibilities and mechanism of government, of course, but I think one must just, as I said, just watch that and it doesn't get out of hand. And then the tax burden, it will increase to 28.4% of GDP next year. It's a long way above the 25% that was set some years ago as a benchmark. I think that clearly points to a broadening in the tax base that's not being fully passed on in terms of lower tax rates. I won't argue for lower tax rates now, but I think in terms of going forward, that is something of a policy nature to be borne in mind. Then I want to come to a couple of policy matters, almost lastly now, Chair. And these are more the things that were absent from the statement. The National Social Security System and the wage subsidy along with that, government intentions that was announced at the time of the budget, we get a rather vague reference now, actually. Now, I accept that as far as the NSSS is concerned, there's ongoing discussions going on. I think government itself is not clear yet on its position. It's quite clear from the publicly available documents that there are differences of opinion between the National Treasury and the Department of Social Development, for example. I accept that it's an ongoing focus still. The wage subsidy that is announced along with the NSSS doesn't essentially have to go with the NSSS. Now, on both of these, we just get the statement that they're very good. I would have liked to get a bit more of a progress report. But in any case, secondly, industrial policy, there also is a bit vague to being a bit critical. If you look at the industrial policy framework that was announced in July, and put that as a program of action, and the program of action, the National Treasury also pinpointed as one of the agents, and there's certain deadlines that stipulated there, many of the deadlines being December 2007, for example, others stretching to March 2008. And here also, the statement is a bit vague. I would have liked to get a more clear response of how the Treasury tends to engage with the industrial policy framework that's been approved by Cabinet. They seem to be more in support of lower tariffs than of incentives, for example. And I think we need a public debate on these issues. On tax policy, as I said earlier on, we've got very little. For example, the tax administration burden on small business that was recognized in February's budget, this time we get a rather soft comment just to say that they recognize it's important, but no progress report. Inflation targeting, we've got nothing. Now, there's an Afrikaans saying, Chair, that says, stolen is worth the answer. Keeping quiet is also a way of answering somebody. But I must say, this is, you could listen to Mr. Mondi, how emotional he got about this issue. This is not something that can be ignored. I think it needs to be debated and that you need to engage people. Now, let me say clearly, I support the position that we should not change the inflation targeting regime at the states, the level of the targets, because I think we will be shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of our credibility. We will give the impression that the first time we reach the upper end of the target, we just change it to whatever, 7% or 8%. So what will that mean? So we get to 7, for argument's sake, we change it to 7, so when we get to 7, then we change it to 8. When we get to 8, we change it to 9. And then the credibility of our whole policy regime starts to be questioned. But as I said, I don't think it's appropriate just to brush it off. I think we should talk about it. Specifically, I just want to say that regarding the issue of employment and the role of monetary policy in that, I think we must make a distinction. You get different kinds of unemployment. Cyclical unemployment, that's just because when the economic cycle turns down, businesses pay off people, but when the economy picks up again, they rehire those people. That's one type of unemployment. Or you get structural unemployment, where people are in long-term unemployment position. And we have the second type. And the countries, if you look at, let's say, the U.S., for example, that in their monetary policy objectives, they specifically state that the Fed must also look at employment, ensure full employment if possible. Then that means in the cyclical sense. Their unemployment rate is now 4.7%. One stage it was about 4%, 3.9% at one stage. So they're basically at full employment, and it's just fluctuations around that level. We have a different situation. You're not going to address our unemployment, structural unemployment problem by just not raising interest rates when inflation goes up. And by the way, in real terms, we've not really increased the increases of only matching inflation so far. It's more of a structural question than for our economy to deal with than for just monetary policy to deal with. Briefly, exchange control, we've got nothing on that, which is, of course, the prerogative of the minister to say nothing about it. But I just want to make one point there. We're all very excited about the Standard Bank transaction, the Chinese buying a big way into Standard Bank. But we'll just bear in mind that implies a future outflow of dividends. 20% of Standard Bank dividends traditionally now flow offshore compared to the past. That 700 million rand in terms of Standard Bank's current dividends, and it will be growing. What bothers me also about this transaction and also the previous Barclays AXA one is that they buy into an existing revenue stream, and which then part of which gets cycled offshore. I would like to see foreign direct investment that creates new revenue streams from which the servicing of those investments get financed. I think it's very necessary that we should keep our debt for foreign asset liability position, that we should keep that in mind. One of the important tests for the sustainability of a current account deficit. If you go into a negative foreign asset situation, a foreign liability situation, and that needs to be serviced, your income balance is negative and growing, that is greatest question marks regarding the sustainability of the current account position. Then lastly, there's two references to how the public corporations will finance the investment spending. But specifically, I just want to focus on the ESCOM issue because nothing is said about that. It's the impression government doesn't intend to make any capital injection. Now, I just want to make the point that a few years ago, we said that we want to manage our public corporation on a commercial basis. And like a private company, if a private company wants to expand capacity, it has to raise additional capital. There's no way that a private company can raise its prices because it wants to expand. It's only a monopoly that can do that. The government as the shareholder in ESCOM and would sort of benefit from the returns on that increased investment in time, to my mind, it's appropriate that there should be an injection of equity into the business. The only other sources could be then by way of the increased tariffs, but surely you can't ask the customers to inject equity into the business. They're not going to get the benefit of that. And then as far as loan capital is concerned, then I think we must bear in mind that if Eskom was to borrow the kind of amounts that's involved here, it would definitely mean a deterioration in the finances, specifically if the tariff increases are capped, which will mean that the credit rating will go down, which will mean it will become more expensive to borrow, so it will become actually more expensive to finance that expansion. The first question, I think at least we should get a statement on the natural dividend, the dividend flow from Eskom to the treasury. To my mind, it would be completely inappropriate for Eskom to pay a dividend to the national treasury while it has these capital requirements. Now, looking at the family budget, there was nothing provided for in terms of for a dividend in the current fiscal year from Eskom. Hopefully, that's an indication that they therefore would agree. It's also not a matter of affordability. The fiscal ratios are going to be very excellent. They're going to improve further. So the capacity is there to assist Eskom to some extent. And I can't help but thinking, Chair, that Eskom has been treated differently from other public corporations. I don't understand why. And other levels of government also, the support to municipalities and provincial governments for their capital expenditure. There's a statement specifically in the medium term budget policy statement that further support will be available to public corporations for restructuring, then for transport and for communications, but energy is left out. And I don't understand why. I think it's an important national issue that needs to be addressed head on. Let me say that I accept our electricity tariffs are too low. They have to increase. But you don't do it by applying a shock to the economy. I think at the minimum, government should come to the party to smooth out this adjustment that will have to come in the cost of energy for the economy going forward. I'm taking too much of your time, so I'll be very brief now, but just finally, evaluation, accelerating growth. I think the state of the region needs a budget policy about maintaining macroeconomic stability, which is fine, improving sustainability, contributes to national savings. It's for carrying in rather than carrying out nature with a reduction in the government borrowing requirements. It removes infrastructure bottlenecks in terms of capital expenditure. I would say only tax policy is the one that's machine specifically the issue of corporate tax that contributes to accelerating growth. In creating employment, growth is what necessary for that. Industrial and trade reform that I mentioned previously, where the Treasury perhaps also has a role to play. There, it's a better participant play. And then, of course, the proposed wage subsidy future is not seen only as protecting the take-home pay of low-paid workers when they have to start to contribute to the national social security system, but the idea is also that there should be something additional to encourage employment. And then the increase in poverty and inequality that takes place through creating employment, so all these things are linked, but providing the safety net, and the statement is very clear that government will protect the real value of the safety net. With the expenditure on that increased by 9% in real terms per year over the next 3 years. The social wage provided, ongoing redistribution to a progressive tax system and also on the expenditure side, and increased allocations to parts, to elements that are important to poor people to be able to engage in the economy, improving their health, their education, their training, their access to the economy via infrastructure and
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. 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 Thank you
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if there is perhaps a way that you could get closer to this screen, because unlike Jack, who can talk very well, also, you know, just like this, it's actually very important that you are able to see what I'm presenting. It's got quite a lot of detailed charts. Is that not protocol to get you to come closer to the screen?
No, it's not a problem. But is it because the part is too small? Because
the screen is
just so tiny. Okay, remember the thing that they always say that the system should move to those sort of edges. But let's then.
Okay,
fine. This would be unfair for me because members can move but I can't move.
They will be copying, like, unfortunately, I was with the minister and the DG last night because we had a session where they explained all this to business people. So my time is not doing my own.
Well, we don't have a hard copy at the moment, but members will do this with the judge at a conversation.
Jim, I have a fair idea what Kumkili and particularly what Jack would be saying, so I didn't think it would be appropriate for me to also make the board in the same point. So what my presentation really is an economic background to the budget. Why I am, for one thing, extremely glad about the way that all this has played out, and that is what I will be illustrating to you. I might perhaps just, I'm not sure that there are too many of these faces who were here in 1994 when I presented to this committee for the first time. If you were, you might recall I have two slides that were still the days of the transparency. The one said, cost of cutting the budget deficit. And I related what those were, and then I had a list that was twice as long for cost of not cutting the budget deficit, in which I then argued why I think it would be a very good idea if indeed the new government after 1994 set about trying to rectify the mess in the government finances that they had inherited. Now, it's not certainly because of my saying so that it happened, but I was very glad that one can now report what you see on this slide, which is the budget deficit, which in the early 90s was extremely large, that was reduced drastically over time, and that as you know better than I, we've now actually gone into a surplus situation. Now that is at the beneficial impact that the ratio of the national debt to GDP has declined. Now if I may just remind you, if we go back to the 1970s and 80s, we also had a decline in that ratio of the debt to GDP, but then it was for a very different reason than the decline which we've seen since 1994. The reason why the deficit declined at that time was simply because the denominator, the nominal GDP, was rising rapidly on account of big inflation. So we were actually hiding the problem through inflation, whereas the decline that we now have in the ratio of the national debt to the GDP is a genuine decline on account of the reduction in the budget deficit that we saw through this period. And as Mr. Manuel, of course, always points out, the impact of that is seen dramatically in the top part of the slide, which shows that we've now managed to reverse the long-term uptrend in the ratio of interest to other spending, or as I call it there, the interest on the public debt as a percentage of current revenue. Now that, as you can see, is just about half, and the point about that is that triangle that sort of opens up there is the money that is now available to be spent on other things rather than on simply the passive or unproductive spending on interest. Now if we go back to the debate that one had in the late 1980s about budget deficits, I wish I at that point had a chart like this to show you know how things might actually evolve, and this is actually extremely good news. Now if you look at the middle triangle, that drop that we saw there is of course what gave us the lowest long-term capital market interest rates, that is what the government has to pay to borrow now that we've had in my career as an economist since the early 1970s. It meant better credit ratings, it meant that foreigners are willing to fund our current account deficit and so forth. So this overall is certainly a very positive picture. What I would like to do with the next sort of set of slides is illustrate the shorter term developments from 1980 onwards. So it is this part of the picture. And let's start with the point that Jacques made very well also, and that in the MTBBS document, as well as in the minister's speech, was also pointed out. And that is that South Africa has been extremely fortunate, we've been lucky, that commodity prices have risen as sharply as they've done, and as I sort of explained there, the terms of trade is literally export price index over import price index. It's like a company. You can raise your prices faster than what your costs are rising, you can make a profit. The same thing goes for a country. Our national income is raised by the fact that our terms of trade have improved in the way that you see there. We can literally buy more stuff abroad for every unit of stuff that we have domestically. And in fact, South Africa has had an amazing combination, a wonderful combination of events in the last 8-9 years or so, and that is that not only has income risen as sharply as you see there, but of course interest rates have fallen. And on top of that, we have what I've also referred to, and that is major capital inflow. So on three scores, we've had a boost to the domestic economy, improving terms of trade, falling interest rates, and very large capital inflows. And that has then provided the basis for the strong growth that we recently had. Now, I don't want to take anything away from government and from the much better management of the economy that we've had, but I think Mr. Manuel, or in the documents yesterday, the day before, they also make very clear that a part of our better economic performance, a part of the turnaround in the long-term downtrend in growth, which has now gone exactly the other way, is something good fortune. It is not just because of what we've done now. So we've had a strong growth, and we've also had, on account of this capital inflow, the ability then to afford the large current account deficits that have recently developed. Now, I should perhaps just point out, as Jacques also did, that a current account deficit is actually three things. It's in the first place, in the most obvious place, the difference between imports and exports. But, as I said there at the bottom, X minus M, but it is also the difference between what we as a nation spend, E, and what we generate as product, or what our income is, Y. And it is also the difference between S and I, which is savings and investment. Those things are an identity. So, on account of those capital inflows at the bottom of this slide, which helps generate that growth, we were then able to afford the current account deficits that we had. But I think a very important point, and I'm glad that the minister's speech as well as the MTBBS document is so open and candid about this. We had those current account deficits despite the fact that we've had rising terms of trade. So we've had commodity prices rising, we've got more for our exports, and yet we were running a large current account deficit. Now just imagine if the terms of trade hadn't improved, if the green line hadn't risen, what that red one, all other things being equal, would then have looked like. So now one can ask, how is it then that this current account deficit developed? And it is here where, like Jack, I don't think one can talk about fiscal policy without talking about monetary policy also. The reason is that E grows a lot faster than Y. So if you look at the purple line, that is the growth in real final demand. It is the sum of consumption spending, government spending, and investment spending, and you'll see that the rate of growth in that over the last number of years was more than 8%, whereas the growth in the GDP, or the output part of this story, was 5%. Now the gap between those two, as you can see on the chart, is then again an explanation for the current account deficit that you see at the bottom of the chart. And this is where the problem that I have with a lot of the critics of the Reserve Bank comes in, or these critics who say that our interest rates have been hopelessly too high and have put the shackles on our economic growth. I think that is simply not true. If we have a look at the blue line at the top of this chart, the prime overdraft rate, it is in the period of falling interest rates, of course, that spending, in that sense, was encouraged. And in particular, the interest rate cut of 2004-2005, which I highlight on the screen there, at that stage then were taken, and I think Jacques implied something there as well, that decision was taken to try and get this economy to grow even faster. But what we didn't fully recognize at the time is that there is a major constraint on the physical, or the growth in the physical output of this economy through skill shortages, infrastructure, bottlenecks, and so forth. So what happened? Domestic demand, of course, rose. Now, if we had listened to those critics of the Reserve Bank to say that we should have cut interest rates even more, what would have happened?
That purple line would have been even further ahead of the red line, which means the current account deficit would have been even larger, because cutting interest rates doesn't give you more skilled people. It doesn't give you more bricks and steel and birds in the in our harbors. And that is why I, for one, am totally in agreement with the Reserve Bank's raising of interest rates that you can see at the top there. Not to squash the economy, not to bring it back into one of these recession phases, not at all, but just to ensure that growth is sustained. Now, I make this little detour because I want now to put what has happened to fiscal policy into the same framework. That purple bar is what you saw on my first slide. It is the budget balance. Unfortunately, we can now move away from talking about budget deficits to talking about budget balance. It's always so that we, it is always a deficit. Now suddenly it's a surplus. Now you can't call it a deficit that is positive anymore. So fortunately, we can now start talking about balance, budget balances. Now, just imagine if in this circumstance, these budget deficits hadn't been cut, how much that would have added to the total demand in the economy, how much that would have added, if we go back to the previous slide, to the size of the current account deficit. And also what the slide explains to an extent is that the rapid growth we've had is also in fact partly an explanation of why the deficit reduced. So the causality actually in a sense runs both ways. And for this reason, I for one am extremely glad that things have evolved in the way that they have, both as far as fiscal policy is concerned, and also with some reservations about the interest rate cuts of 2004-2005 on monetary policy. Now, why do guys like ourselves carry on so much about this current account deficit? If we compare South Africa with a range of other emerging markets, you will see, and I think Jack made that point as well, that our company is Hungary, Pakistan, and Turkey. We are way at the bottom of this set of countries, in that we are one of the very few that are actually, in this sense, living beyond our means. And then I don't think it is coincidental that we are also part of that group of countries that has inflation that is double the inflation rate of the countries that are running surpluses. So you'll see, if you exclude Venezuela and Russia, both of whom are major oil exporters and have somehow not seem to be able to contain the inflation in their economy. Venezuela's case, Chavez will soon have some problems with inflation rate of 17% already, Russia's 8%. To exclude those two, those countries running surpluses, including China, had very much lower inflation than South Africa had. And it is not as if we are running deficits because we are growing so rapidly, because look where we feature in the league of these same countries, just mixed in a different way, in the league of economic growth. That is, guys at the top are able to grow rapidly, and yet they are not generating, for the most part, large current account deficits. And I think the point that Jacques made is very valid. If you were an investor, now remember those capital inflows accounts are almost all portfolio type flows. That movie can, oh, that movie, that capital can go with a click of a mouse. If trouble had to be foreseen for these countries as a group, who's going to be sold off first? Those that aren't performing, those ones who therefore aren't providing strong earnings flow, and of course those who need the money most, that is those like South Africa at the bottom there that are running current account deficits. So again, if the ministry makes a big song and dance of the current account and of the dangers and of the necessity for a countervailing fiscal policy such as I believe we now have, I think they need the support of this House, and certainly also as far as the Reserve Bank is concerned. If they make these same points, I think they deserve our support rather than our criticism. Printing more money, that is an easier monetary policy, or a bigger budget deficit, is not going to give us more jobs for all the reasons that that Jacques also mentioned. Just a final slide, and that will be my lot. I am concerned that I'm not going to discuss the HWBS in any kind of detail, but I am somewhat concerned by the trend in government spending. Just to take you back a bit, under GEAR, we, I think correctly, had to first improve the quality of spending and contain its expansion. Then with the social spending cut, the ratio of spending to GDP started to climb, and currently, of course, that is rising even faster. And in order for us to maintain these much better budget numbers, of course, it's been necessary to have this up, to have the ratio of revenue to GDP rise sharply. And I'm actually concerned that in the short space of, 4 years, we've gone from the ratio there, 24% to the ratio that we now have. And I think this is the very least that should have happened, that these two lines now, as they are, they should have crossed, which is a good thing, but that they are leveling out, I think, is as good a thing. And I'm perhaps a little bit worried that maybe the pace of spending remains, even though it's slowed down from 9% to 6.4%, perhaps on the rapid side. But I'm not going to deal with any of this stuff in depth. I just saw my role, Chairman, as perhaps providing a little bit of a broader background to the perhaps to your and to my understanding of how these things fit together, and that is in my presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm now going to request that all presenters take the first six so that you can struggle to direct questions and comments.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, sorry, I just see, could I have another 5 minutes? I've actually used less of my time than I could.
Economists can push you. I didn't tell you how many times. How do you know you're good at
it? Okay, I'm taking
it. No, it's okay. Yeah, do it.
That'll literally take 4 or 5 minutes. I think there is a popular misconception that the RAND strength has been massive and that has served to limit the economy. Now, let me just quickly explain what I'm doing here. I'm going to plot indexed to 100 in 1994, a range of countries' real effective exchange rate, that is the exchange rate adjusted for inflation differentials. Now that is Japan. For a variety of reasons, the Japanese exchange rate has fallen sharply in real terms, and the major reason, of course, is that they have deflation. That is Switzerland. That is the United States. That is the euro exchange rate. That is Canada. That is the UK. That is Australia. And that is New Zealand. Now, if people complain about how this is now each of them against a basket of currencies adjusted for inflation. Now, if people complain about the rand, I think they must have its strength, an idea of where it actually is. And the fact of the matter is that South Africa is at the bottom of the league. Apart from Japan, there are none of these countries whose currencies have been weaker than that of South Africa in real effective terms, weighted against the basket of currencies. Australia and New Zealand are also commodity exporting nations. Look how strong their currencies have been. Now, we can also compare ourselves with a number of other currencies. Now, unfortunately, and this will be my last slide share, I don't have real effective exchange rates, but let's have a look at nominal exchange rates for a number of these currencies, and I'm plotting them against the rand. So,
rand equals to 100 there, you'll see that against the Philippine peso, we are today exactly where we were at the beginning of 2000.
So that would be a strengthening rand, that would be a weakening rand. So the rand has actually fallen, as you can see, very substantially by 40% against the peso since its peak at the beginning of 2006. That is the rand against the Indian rupee. So you see we are 10% lower against the Indian currency now than we were in 2000. That is the rand against the Korean won. So we are 25% weaker against the one than we were in 2000. And then the currency that everybody talks about, as if they are keeping themselves artificially low, is the Chinese currency, the renminbi. And you can see we are 20% lower against the Chinese currency than we were in 2000. So the point that I just want to make with this slide is that I think there are misperceptions about what the rand has done. The rand has actually, relatively speaking, been a weak currency. And to try and artificially manipulate its level down through, for instance, cutting interest rates or whatever, I don't think is certainly the way to go. Where I would agree with Jacques is that is what he was arguing, is that an abolition of exchange controls, I think, would certainly be a major improvement that may lead the rand to weaken, but certainly we'd have a more market-determined exchange rate. So that is all that I just wanted to add, Chairman.
Thank you very much. Useful information indeed. I trust that members have been writing and noting their questions. I am now open for questions, comments, Mr. Mulato, Mr. Finn. Thank you, Chair. I just want to propose one or two questions to the IEC and then the rest to the other presenters. You mentioned that our capacity utilization is at 86%. Now, my following to that, we indicated that there's underinvestment in capacity. I just want to find out whether you have been monitoring the trends in steel production and cement production. And lastly, the mining sector, whether there's been any significant investment in those sectors in terms of their capacity. The other question that I wanted to pose to the other two presenters was on the international situation. To what extent do you think the likelihood of a credit crunch would have a negative impact on South Africa? Given all these recent developments on the subprime and even some hedge funds and clothing, what would be the likely effect on South Africa of those kind of occurrences? I think the matter has been sufficiently dealt with on inflation targeting. But I just want to find out from the IGC what would be the best route to contain inflation. Without using interest rates, because it seems that was the implied suggestion. And lastly, would you be able to explain to us what were the main drivers of shortages in milk production? Mr. Finn.
Thank you very much, Chair. Firstly, thank you very much for arranging these presentations. I think they've been very educational, especially to me. Thank you to all the presenters. Firstly, Mr. Lopsha, I think one of the things that he's spoken about at length on the policy matters was Eskom financing. And you mentioned that the minister said nothing about it. And you're quite right that if we're looking at double-digit increases in tariffs, it's going to have an effect on inflation and interest rates as a consequence. But when this question was posed, and Unochange was posed to the minister the other day, I mean, he directly said, if it doesn't hit you, don't scratch. There's been no request from Eskom for any sort of government funding for the infrastructure that they require. So that was the answer that we received from the minister. So I think I agree with Mr. Lopsha, Chair, that when it comes to industrial policy, maybe we need to meet with our trade and industry counterparts and maybe other portfolio committees to start talking about incentivization, particularly in rural areas. And I think although there's industrial growth in the mines and in urban areas, we talk about urban renewal, something needs to be done in the rural area. And maybe we should look at policies of the past, not necessarily that they were the best, but to see how we can accelerate industrial growth and to make sure that there are jobs and things like that, in particular the rural areas. Mr. Monti was very, very, very interesting, and here again we had quite a long debate on the effects of food prices on inflation. In fact, the minister circulated to us a contribution of food inflation to headline inflation around the world. And we found that, South Africa and China, the contribution was between 25 and 50%, but there were countries around the world with more than 75%. And that was quite interesting. But coming to food, what would Mr. Mondi's view be on this committee that was set up by government to look at the food pricing strategies. Do you not think that maybe there are companies that are riding on the bandwagon and artificially increasing prices, but thereby increasing their profits, which are passed on to commoners like ourselves? So when we go in, we have to pay more for milk and more for bread, and then that causes an increase in inflation. And I'll stop there. Sorry, just one other thing. When Mr. Monday spoke about shortage of food and things like that, this whole biofuels industry that is being proposed, and I know IGC are part of it, what kind of impact is it going to have on food production? In your view?
Your mic. Thank you.
And I think this presentation is very educational for some of us who are not economists. The first one that I want to hop on relates more to the issue on administrative taxes. A very interesting statement I made. especially from Mr. Lofshan, or Mr. Fox, I can't remember. The fact that you had government almost supporting all these other public corporations, say for Apple. It's a very interesting statement. And the question there is, a big one, whether you are saying anything to government about this particular entity that says it is able to sustain itself as a business going entity. We've had statements the other day about SAA and it's being a bottomless pit and so on and so forth. But it's got nothing to do with the administrative prices. But more importantly, whether also when you raise prices, like you have now in Eskom, you only do that, point is made, when you are a monopoly. Government has just agreed on getting to find other private investors to come into the sector that is energy. I would imagine that it's going to be a long haul for this to come in. But in the meantime, like you've heard in Telkom, they are the only player in the field. If you could comment on that one, especially on the sustainability and some of these entities being not able, but more importantly on the administrative crisis. This have a very, very negative impact, as we all agree, on our targets as a set, especially on the inflation side of things. So that's the first part, Chair. The second part, a statement is made about having not to confine ourselves to monitoring fiscal policy for all the years. What else can I say in terms of policy determination can we really attribute as we try to address some of the problems that we've identified? The last one, Chair, I was just trying to, without being what's the English word? English being a fourth language. Without being sarcastic. What is the background by Lofshan? On one slide here that says growing and persistent imbalances in the economy. And then trying to imagine myself being a communist. Will we ever reach at any point in given time to socialism? In your view? For now, thanks.
Can I take it in this way? Such as the body
Thank you, Chin. One of the biggest challenges in South Africa is around the social contract. That at a time when we are very much aware that government is sitting in a very critical issue, budget deficits have become very, very low, and government is making very clear in the second term of President Bailey as to what his government is going to do in terms of public investment into infrastructure in particular. That when we engage with businesses, because we are very privileged that we have information from the Department of Public Enterprise around what they wanted to do, particularly the two enterprises as common transmit. On engaging the major players in terms of their capacity, we were told very clearly that it's a pie in the sky, it can never happen. Because between 1992 and 1994, some of these companies expected a black government, I'm using that word, they expected a black government to care for its people. That the reconstruction and development program was going to be implemented by this government up post 1994 election. So a lot of these companies went into huge capital investment into new cement capability, into additional production capacity in the steel sector. And 1994 came, the government conservative and prudent fiscal policy. These companies retrench a lot of these workers. The workers that we see today in England, we see them in particularly in Dubai, with civil engineers, etc. Those are the workers that some of whom were lost during that period because government never came to the party at all. So the picture I'm painting is that when we went back to this business in 2004-2005, they were very clear that we're crazy. This has happened. So now they're responding to this huge GDP growth that we've seen. And they can't meet the demand. And hence, we're operating at manufacturing production at full capacity. So if you talk to PPC, you talk to Lafarge, you talk to policy, they're all adding additional capacity. You talk to my colleague at Mittal Steel, we're adding additional capacity. So everyone is trying to respond, but responding at a period whereby globally there's excess demand in terms of infrastructure investment. So the price ticket is enormous, and hence my argument around continuous increases on input cost. Because the Chinese have booked about, if you're talking about Eskom, on turbines, probably Eskom is about 60 on the queue. So this is the challenge we're facing on capacity, that we're trying to meet the demand with the capabilities of turning this economy into one of the best, but our capacity constraints are abiding us big time. So there is commitment from private sector now, although they are lagging, to build this capacity. But somehow, somewhere, we need to work together into a position whereby we work as a country, that there is credibility on all sides, on the investment plan, on the way forward. That vision of a better life for all is shared by everyone, not only by a few. Because that for me remains a big constraint, that there is no harmony between government and business as to what the vision of the country is going to be. So there's always investment lagging on those. The issue around the shortage is a very interesting one. Because for a long, long time, milk prices were very, very low. So what happens is people, farmers, but that's what business, because you know, it was very efficient for you to be farming in that sector. So they all switched away to other areas, whether it's what you call horticulture, going to table grapes, going into blueberries and other high value added agricultural crops. So we all cut short now, because suddenly there is a structural shortage, because you know there aren't many dairy farmers globally, and that's been one of the biggest impacts that has led to this huge price around milk. On the food inflation we are seeing, for me it's very very fascinating. I'm really looking forward to the Competition Commission naming some of these big players in that chain. We know very, very well. I've got no proof. But based on what I hear, particularly from the poor, because the poor are the ones that are buying in volumes. They might not have the nuclear money's income, but in terms of the food, the basic food, the biggest consumer of that food. So there, I want to argue, without being sued by this company, that we believe that the arguments that sector is not committed at all. Whether the commission finds remains to be seen. But I think we're going to see some interesting news in the next few months when the Competition Commission comes out with its findings, because you cannot have a situation whereby every December, bread prices go up. Because, you know, generally, the poor get excited, like all of us, around December. So you never apply your mind about how much the cost of bread is. It only catches up in January, because in January, we've got to pay for school uniforms and school fees. Then when you go to the bakery or to the corner shop, you find that the bread has gone up. Then you are stuck, because there's something wrong in that market. And I hope the commission will help us on that one. My biggest concern, the IDC is very involved in biofuels. So I'm talking here as an economist, not as an IDC. My view is that in Southern Africa, we're prone to drought. I mean, all of us know. And food security is a big issue. So I'm very, very concerned, firstly, about the South African energy strategy in terms of biofuels. That perhaps here, our relationship with Brazil through our India-Brazil South Africa partnership should inform us that maybe we work very close with Brazil and around the issue, given the fact that they're highly competitive globally. They've been there, they've done that. That find ourselves knowing that we're prone to drought, that our food security is threatened, put a huge focus on that sector. So that's my advice, but you know, I'm one of many, so we get a lot of advisors in that area. Thank you.
Yeah, Chairperson, there's a lot to respond to. I will pick a couple of issues. Let's first of all starting with a question regarding the international situation and its effect on South Africa. The starting point, as I said, of course, of the recent problems in the international economy has been there in the U.S. with the subprime issue, the land delinquencies, and the decline that's caused in their property market. And it's quite interesting if you look at how it's affecting the U.S. economy. They came out with third quarter GDP growth numbers yesterday, day before. And if you distinguish between the growth in the economy, including or excluding the construction sector, housing construction in particular, you get a vastly different picture. Including housing construction, you have a growth rate of 3.6%, if I remember correctly now. If you exclude housing construction, it's about 5%. It just shows you what enormous drag the problem in the housing sector in the U.S. is causing on the economy. The question there now is with the property prices are declining. Property prices, the median price is now about 4% lower than what it was a year ago. And that causes then for the borrowers additional problems, specifically people that bought at the high prices and took out 100% loans, mortgages, and they are now in negative equity. It's actually for them better to go to the bank and to say to the bank, well, yes, this is your problem now, it's not mine anymore. But one lesson, by the way, out of that is for me, is just shows you our own National Credit Act, how appropriate it is. Many of the problems that have arisen in the US in that subprime market would have been avoided if they had something like our National Credit Act. But that's the first thing, is through the housing sector. And the question is, though, will we see similar problems in other countries in the housing sector? We've seen big rises in property houses, in property prices, house prices, in a range of countries in the past 7-8 years, including South Africa also. Apart from the check on the housing sector question, then the next question is, but if housing prices were to decline, what will that mean to consumer confidence and to consumer spending in general? And if that were to decline, then that will dampen economic growth. Then the third aspect is to say, but okay, banks are now more reluctant to lend money to more risky borrowers. Not only in the subprime market, but they've now also in the business sector, for example, the more companies that's more risky, they're more reluctant to lend money to them. In the corporate bond market, commercial paper market, companies that finance themselves by borrowing money in the commercial paper market, they find they can't do it anymore. So it's almost like if you've had a big unexpected tightening in monetary policy, that there's less credit available, which is only available on more expensive terms, so business activity gets hampered as a result of that. So therefore there's no doubt the US economy is slowing down, is going to continue slowing down into next year. Then the next question is now the rest of the world. Will the rest of the world be able to decouple from the US? Now unfortunately, the US is still about a quarter of the world economy. And the U.S. consumer is about two-thirds of the U.S. economy in terms of spending, so none of the U.S. consumer is about 17-18% of the world economy. So if they were to spend less, if you see a contraction there, I can't see how the rest of the world can really completely decouple from it. But fortunately, we do have the situation that in the emerging market world, we've seen those economies undergoing structural improvements in recent years that will protect them now to some extent. And specifically, the important issue is their growth drivers. It's become more dependent on the domestic economy, and there's room, actually, in many countries to encourage that further. We want to refer to China, for example. And if you look at Chinese growth, their growth has come from mostly from investment spending and from net exports. Very little from the consumer side. They have huge potential, and they actually need to expand their consumer household, consumer side of their economy. So, although I don't think that there will be an effect, there will not be complete decoupling, these factors that will protect us to some extent. Now, how this impacts on us is the two ways. We benefit from global growth through our exports, both in terms of volumes and in terms of prices, specifically the commodity prices. So if growth slows down, economic activity slows down in the world, then commodity prices, if they don't fall, at least they're going to increase very rapidly. And that will have an impact on us. And secondly also, the flow of capital globally. People tend to accept, the more prepared to accept risk when growth is strong. And we've seen that therefore with the strong global growth has come the strong increase in capital flows to emerging countries that's perceived to be more risky. And on that point, by the way, someone who made a comment, if you look at it, the problems that we've seen recently was with developed economies, not in emerging economies. So the comment is to say that, but all economies are risky. Emerging economies are just pricing in the risk. But just on the side of that. So if the risk appetite were to decline, you would see less capital going to more risky assets, including emerging markets, and that would include our own, and then our current account deficit becomes a problem. But I must admit, Jeremy, if I think back over the past 18 months at least, I personally have been warning about this issue. And it's not really come to a point. And so to some extent, I think we have to ask ourselves also, but has something fundamentally, structurally changed? And that therefore we should be less pessimistic about the risk to the emerging world and including ourselves. The problem with that is you will only know it a couple of years down the line. The level of uncertainty at the moment, I can't answer that question, but I have the sense that perhaps we should start to think differently, but nevertheless, how do you manage the risk? And we're accepting some risk already by running the current account deficit as big as it is. So I don't think we should run more risk than that. That's on the international side. Then just on the food inflation, just a point, it's an international phenomenon. It struck me yesterday, the Eurozone, the ECB came out with new inflation numbers. The inflation was also higher than what they expected, and there were two reasons, food and fuel. And then you will find, almost you go around the world, almost in every country you get that phenomenon. Now, of course, in the emerging world, as you rightly pointed out, food is a higher percentage of the basket, so it impacts bigger, it's a bigger extent on the inflation. But specifically, the biggest, one of the biggest factors have been wheat prices. Wheat prices internationally have shot up. Earlier this week, we again reported a drought in Australia, for example. And we, of course, we're the net wheat importer. So we can't escape from those effects. And that impacts on the trade price. And unfortunately, I have to say, I think further increase in the wheat price will be unavoidable, looking at the increases in wheat prices. And that, of course, then directly play that's quite a high weighting in the food basket. So unless food inflation and food prices were to subside internationally, it's difficult to see it happening here locally. The best thing perhaps to say is that at least there's a base effect now, so perhaps by the end of next year we'll be looking at zero food inflation, but just can't go on at the same tempo. Thirdly, the issue of administrative crisis. Administrative crisis, of course, not only about public corporations, it includes other things also. And for example, one of the reasons why our own CPIF numbers that came out last week was an unpleasant surprise again to the upside, was because of wage increases for domestic workers, which is the minimum wage that's regulated there. That were increasing more than what people were expecting. So it's also those kind of things that we have to look at. It's not only pricing in the public corporations if we talk about administrative crisis. Administrative crisis a year or two ago was a problem. Then it was ranging very nicely. In government was very outspoken about the cost of doing business and about limiting increases in the cost of doing business. I get the feeling that's been pushed into the background a little bit. But as far as the public corporations is concerned, I ask myself the same question about the sustainability of some of those corporations, whether the business plan or the business case actually is sound. And that's a question I think for government to answer, but you can't continue putting money into a black hole and just disappearing there. Some stage you have to stop and say, okay, but this thing is not viable anymore. On the other hand, private investors in electricity, especially on the generation side, fact of the matter is, as far as I'm aware, they're not queuing up to get involved. The way I would see it is, it's not viable for Eskom itself to increase capacity without substantial increase in their tariffs. And it can't be viable also for private investors. So that's part of the whole issue. They're not going to come in just the business case is not sound. The great matter of monetary and fiscal policy is not confining ourselves only to that. I refer to a number of things in industrial policy, in labor policy, education and training, we have to get that right. I think that's a crucial issue. And we're talking about it, and we continue talking about it, and that's correct, but we need results, and we need them very, very, very rapidly. The imbalances in the economy, I don't think there's any economy that will ever be fully imbalanced. That would imply an economy with zero unemployment, zero inflation, zero anything. We're never going to achieve that. And in terms of economic systems, where I see there's no ideal one. If you look at the world now, and if you look at the history, then all economic systems over time develop imbalances. And it's about the managing those imbalances, and as imbalances as they arise, the economy responding to that, to adjust and to work those imbalances out of the system again. And to my mind, a market economy, or what perhaps I should say, a mixed economy that's biased towards a market system is proving itself to be the most flexible one to deal with the imbalances as they arise. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Holtz.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think there was a question specifically directed at me, and I think you've answered certainly all of those to my satisfaction. If I understood the question on socialism correctly, if South Africa were the only country in the world, or one of very few, then I'm afraid we will be one of those countries that will not attract skills and technology and capital to itself, and it will find skills and capital and technology fleeing the economy. I mean, we have perhaps two examples now of socialist economies in the world, and that's North Korea and Cuba. China, I visited there, that is a capitalist economy in all but name. The state certainly has a large role in many respects, but private property is now being entrenched as a concept in China, and certainly nobody is going to take the risk of investing money, of therefore creating jobs and incomes and welfare and so forth, if they do not have ownership of the means of production. So that is certainly a debate that I can answer in the same university that we had in great things in the 1960s, but it is not a debate that is really happening anywhere in the world. It is now to do, as you have indicated also, it is how do you accommodate the legacies of apartheid? What is the role for the state in that? I certainly am not one for a total free market economy. As I said, that is not practical. It will not last in South Africa, but the idea of a socialist economy, I think, will remain a dream, I'm afraid.
Better question? Mr. Block, okay. Mr. Bailey. Yeah, Mr. Block. My first question is related to the point that you made in the MTDP. The argument here is that one of the reasons why you see an increase in economic activity in the construction, financial services, transportation, communication, wholesale, and retail sector is because of lower costs in this sector. Now, my question is that focusing on manufacturing, which to me becomes the real economy. Are the depreciation allowance that are advanced or given by government enough to increase, to encourage fixed investment? Or what more can we still do from government side, from tax policy side, to encourage the investment by the manufacturing sector? The second question would be the argument on lowering tariffs. In one of our hearings, I can't recall the specific day, one of the presenters of the economy argued that South Africa in certain sectors, specifically I think with reference to agriculture, we have lowered the tariffs beyond the norm. I just want to find from your experience whether that's the case, and whether the argument for the value of talents indeed increase competitiveness or relief to this industrialization. Chair, my other question would be the point, unfortunately, we don't have the slide for the presentation of Mr. Holt. I would like him to repeat the argument that he advanced he was talking about the E. I don't have the slide, that's why I'm slightly confused. He was saying that even if we had increased interest rate or whatever, we would have addressed, you talk about the E and Y. I'm not sure whether you get my point on the argument that I was making. I just want you to repeat that argument and advance it more quite clear to us, but I don't have the slides of that one. Chair, I think for me, those would be the two key questions.
Thanks, Chair. Joining my colleague by thanking the panel for the very thoughtful and fruitful presentation, all of them combined. But this one specifically to Mr. Mondi. He's asking that, rightly so, I believe that the poor spend almost all their earnings on transport and food, and looking at the escalation of the oil prices and food prices, what would be a developmental stage, if you like, do to address that issue? Because for me, it cannot be left to the market to address, in my view, a developmental stage in South Africa will need to do something to address that fundamental issue, and if I'm right, what to do. That's the first one. The second one, this question has been posed already, but I just need your comment here with regard to the proposed issue here. We'll talk about the issue of proposed 18% hardified by ELCOM on their challenge. Again, the issue here has been mentioned by one of the panelists that energy in South Africa is cheap. I don't know about this, but we are getting ourselves with who? Because in my view, energy remains electricity in particular, it remains one of the very scarce commodities to the poor of the poor. And then if an increase is mentioned here of 18% for that matter, if we go ahead, it makes one very scary, and further linked to that, what does that do into our endeavor of attracting investment and creating more jobs? Thank you. That's for me.
Thank you. The next question is Mr. Johnson, but I have a request.
because I have a request from Mr. Holt that he wants to believe this 11:20. So can I? Because the one question directed to him by Mr. Blunder, and he has had the advantage of being in the chair also, so he decides who when what happens. So he just instructed me back before I release you, but can I allow you to respond to my question, and then we'll proceed to the other question.
Thank you, Chairman. I really apologize for this appointment that I had long before I was invited to speak, I'm afraid. So I think this question, this slide, is just the one that you were referring to, would perhaps illustrate the point. And I'm not sure, I don't have the technology, I'll get it big on the screen here, but it isn't a mouse. Somebody able to jump in. Spending by households, government consumption spending and investment. That growth rate is running way ahead of the growth rate of output in the economy. Now, one of the objects perhaps of the cut in interest rates there was to try and get growth going even faster, but the point is that there are all sorts of constraints, skilled labour, bricks and so forth that we heard about, that constrain the ability of the economy at this stage to grow much faster. I'm pretty certain that as ESA is implemented, as the bottlenecks are removed, as the fixed investment occurs, and so forth, that the potential growth rate of the economy will be raised, and the red line itself will be able to rise. But in the meantime, we now have a situation where domestic demand is rising way ahead, or was rising way ahead of domestic output, and that difference, of course, has to come from somewhere. It comes from the rest of the world, and therefore the difference between exports and imports is there also the difference there between income and expenditure. And apart from inflation, concerns about inflation, which as I illustrated, countries that run current account deficits typically are also not aware, but typically have been among emerging market countries with high inflation. There was therefore good reason for the Reserve Bank to have acted in the way that they had recently done. I don't know if that is a fuller explanation of the slide. I'm sorry, it is rather a busy picture, and I will make copies of the slides available to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khosrow. We will release you. Your apology is accepted. What becomes important for us is if you are just able to avoid yourself, even if it's just for 5 minutes.
So you said it again, sir?
I'm saying what's important to us is if you're just being able to avail yourself with the information that we've just got from you. It's actually very useful to have you here, but you are asking.
I thought if you could just one before he is and his comment here. You made mention of the point that led to the unproductive spend, especially as we talk here about the budget surplus. Among other issues in the mail that the National Treasury talk about when it really has to prioritize its spend. It talks about having to reduce the debt cost. I would imagine that is what you're referring to. You're talking about the unproductive spend on interest rate cost of that debt cost. What could be alternatives that maybe we should have in mind on that and productive cost of the surplus in terms of what the National Treasury currently has a policy and cabinet is having?
Trying to see, bear with me for a moment, please. I think the point here was just that the more we borrow, the more eventually, of course, interest we will have to pay. Otherwise, we steal from the people that we are borrowing from. And the point that Jacques made also is that if we attract foreign capital, which I think is a good thing, we must also just bear in mind that nothing comes for free. That if you talk about the country as well, the current account deficit, if that is funded with foreigners buying shares in South Africa or buying bonds, they have to be remunerated in terms of interest and dividends, and that again is an outflow. So at the end of the day, that becomes a limitation to the size of the deficit that the country can run, the current account deficit. Now, the same that applies to a country actually applies to a household, I'm sure you all agree, but it also applies to the fiscus, to the government, and that is the point of this slide, that if you look at the green portion, by the end of the 90s, we were spending more than R1 in fine of what the government was spending, was spent merely to pay the interest on the money that they got on account of the big budget deficits that we had before. And then the brave, I think politically extremely brave, stance that particularly Mr. Manuel took, to sell the idea of smaller deficits and eventual surpluses to his colleagues. That has paid off very handsomely in that we now eventually can spend a lot less on this kind of unproductive spending. Now there's also other kinds of unproductive spending, and that is simply wasteful, like we had in old South Africa, building toilets for every different race group and having 14 different education departments, and even today all sorts of wasteful spending on maybe, this is not for the press, expanding these facilities. Doesn't seem to me to be the kind of thing that this country now needs, given everything else that we need to spend money on. So that is a different kind of unproductive spending. I'm not sure that is what you were after. So.
No, Ted, you are answering me. I guess this is more of a debate because there is a view that especially from the left, which I would imagine your sentiments seemingly are aligned to that left. You know, rather than having to spend more, though the arguments from the National Treasury do reflect a view that says, you rather reduce that debt and be able to release more funds. The view that says you have that surplus that must be made use of for those productive, if you like, spend. The point you are raising here says you don't need all of these expansions of parliament and you need them. Rather, that money you need to spend somewhere else, which is basically the point you are raising.
Chair, if I may just expand on that. If you look at this same chart, and I'm sorry I don't have all my pictures here, from 1983, from 1983, a large and growing portion of the old National Party government spending was incurred more on current spending than on capital spending. But the deficit continued to rise. That means the government was borrowing money to pay civil servant salaries. Now that means that our children will be paying for those civil servants that were employed in the 80s and 90s. And again, under the ANC government, what has happened is that this saving by the state, that is borrowing to pay the current expenditure, it's like going to Pick and Pay and buying groceries with your mortgage bond. That is what the old government was doing. Gradually, that was whittled away until now, at last year, we had a situation where the current expenditure, or a portion of that, was not being funded with borrowing anymore. And that is when the government now started to become a saver and therefore contributing to the reduction of the budget deficit, which is, I think, something our children will be extremely grateful for down the line. Now, to say that this budget surplus is money that's not being spent, as Jacques explained, part of the reason why we are running a budget surplus at the moment, is because of the fortuitous circumstances that we've had of an economy growing rapidly, commodity prices rising, that boosting the government revenue. So cyclically adjusted for those things, we do not have a surplus. We've got a deficit of some kind, and as Jacques correctly indicated, there's debate about how big that cyclically adjusted deficit is. But in fact, we must just know that we've got a windfall. And I think Mr. Manuel made that point very clearly in his budget speech. We've got a windfall which if we spend it now, if we load on expenditures now, then we sit with a major problem down the line. So I think this MPBBS warrants our total support and yours. Chairman, I unfortunately
got a bit about 2 minutes or two beyond your 21st, but thank you very much. It really was a pleasure engaging with you. Thank you. Let's talk to your questions have been done with. And I guess my question. Seven questions.
Yeah.
You had seven?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because in addition to the five, we have seven. Can I take Ms. McCarthy first and then to you?
And
Ms. Johnson.
It's actually one, Chair. The someone talk about the other one was the one that I was just on. The someone talk about the inflation target in our country between 3-6%, and there is now talk about increasing that, you know, going through this Moody's report as well. We are, you know, seeing a situation where we are not really going to be at the extreme as, you know, assuming as their views are concerned, which, I mean, are strictly in line with the other, you know, economies are concerned. Do we have a situation wherein we have such targets in place? Health. And what is the norm average out there? Of course, this question is really dictated upon by, you know, the various you know, economies that are there, the level in which performance goes. But if we could get a sense and be schooled in this regard.
Okay,
so
W,
you
There are two important slides that I think we didn't talk about. One was the comparison of the JSP versus the emerging market equity, and which I think is quite important to me. The last one was on the South Africa versus USA 10-year policy yield. So that comparison. What are the key messages that are emerging from this slide?
Jay, if I can respond to that last question first. Yes, I didn't cover those two graphs. The purpose of the graphs is just to indicate to you, first place, that the inflows that we've been getting, the capital inflows, have been mostly of the nature of portfolio capital. So it's really dependent on how our financial markets do. If the financial markets perform well, we'll get portfolio inflows. If the financial markets underperform, the share prices fall, for example, we get less capital inflow. And those two graphs just illustrate to you that our performance, both in the equity market and in the bond market, has been in line with what's been happening in emerging markets in general. So as long as the emerging market story holds, I think we're fine. But if the emerging market story were to unravel, then we have a problem. We were caught up. We were caught up in that. That is the purpose of that. If I could just then one of the other things here on the inflation target is there's now exactly the number of countries, but I think it must be now between 20 and 30 countries in the world that have official inflation targets in place as we have. So it might sound like a small number, but then if you think in terms of the countries that really count in the world, both in the developed world and also in the emerging world where we fall, more in terms of our peer group, the number of countries adopting inflation targets has actually been increasing. And just to the US Federal Reserve, for example, is one of the countries that has not had an inflation target in the year. And they've now appointed a technical committee to look at it. Ben Bernanke has been in the academic days one of the big supporters of the whole idea of inflation targeting. It's been accepted, I think, internationally as far as monetary policy is concerned as almost best practice. It includes, well, New Zealand was the first country to adopt inflation targeting, and after that we had UK, we had Canada, we had Sweden, and so on. It's only in the last 5 years plus from Karachi that you see more emerging market countries also adopting it. Now, as far as the ranges are concerned, generally speaking, they have tighter ranges than what we have, and they have lower caps than the 6% than what we have. I stand to be corrected, but I think there's only 2 countries that have higher upper ends to the targeting bands. The one is Brazil that has an upper end of 7, but they have a central point of 4.5, similar as what we have in terms of our targeting band. And they manage their policy also with a view to that central point, not with a view to the 7%. The other one is now escaping which country that is. I think inflation targeting is very motivation around introducing it specifically in emerging market countries is mostly to gain credibility for economic for monetary policy and to manage inflation expectations. Now, I must admit that I personally often feel that inflation targeting is not the thing or the thing. That in time, I think it's necessary amongst economists at least that there should be a debate about whether it's the best policy regime, whether at some stage it doesn't become too mechanical. But to take away from what is regarded as international best practice now, I think would be difficult if you're not part of a global trend. The other issue just briefly on the food prices and how it affects the poor. Well, I could see in the CPI in the basket that the weighting of food for the low-income groups is 40% and above 40% and below 20% for the high-income groups. Now, the current way that we calculate the CPIX, we weight the different income groups depending on their spending. And actually, the high-income groups spend more than the low-income groups, so the average gets calculated is biased towards the high-income group. Now, we're going to get a new basket introduced next year, and Stats have actually indicated that they're going to change the way that issue is handled, that they're going more going to look at and to try and say, okay, the basket should be reflective more in terms of the majority of the number of households rather than how much you spend, what's your total spend. And that implies, therefore, that the new CPI and CPIX measure will move more towards the bigger weighting to how poor experience inflation, which I think will be a welcome thing. What to do about it, not leading it to the market? I won't distort prices by introducing subsidies and that kind of thing, because then you're undermining the functioning of the market. You should rather look at other ways. And I see some of that in this budget. I see comments about expanding the food, the school feeding program, for example. I think that's one of the ways to do it. And I've noticed in the statement, in the speech that Minister said, about 4.3 billion rand over the NDF period will go towards compensating pension and social grant beneficiaries for rising food prices and other cost of living increases. Now, to my mind, that can create for me the perception that once we get to February next year and we get an announcement on the size of the increase into social grant, that it's going to be higher than your average general CPIX or CPI inflation, because food inflation is now running at 12% plus. It's food inflation is almost double your average level of inflation. And to compensate social grant beneficiaries and pensions for that, it means therefore that the increases will have to be higher than just the general average level of inflation. Now, I don't know whether that's what the Treasury has in mind, they didn't tell us, but that's what I read between the lines there. Lastly, just one further word on the ESCOM tariff. We just remember that ESCOM's claiming for 18% and 70% increases next year and this year after that, which cumulatively onwards amount to almost 40%. It's not only about financing the expansion program, it's also about higher coal prices. Coal prices, of course, are then using coal power stations mostly, is a big part of their total cost. Coal prices generally are very highly correlated with oil prices because they both fossil fuels, to some extent they can be substituted, and we all know what happens to oil prices. Now, in ESCOM's case, they have long-term contracts for the supply of coal for some of the electricity generation, but not for all of it. And therefore, there's a marginal part that kicks in where they have to pay market price. And their average coal price that they had to pay in the previous financial year 2006 increased by almost 14%. Compared to the tariff increase within roughly about 6%. So there's also that part that we, I think, must just remember. I think ESCOM is not completely out of order, as far as I'm concerned, to say that, but somehow this has to be taken into account. I must admit that if I look at the formula there, linking ESCOM's tariff increases to CPI inflation, I find it in principle a bit difficult because the costs are not really driven by CPI inflation. The costs are driven by other factors and the different rates than general inflation. So even if you were to say that there were to be some other way, the capital expenditure were to be financed without having any impact on tariffs, it would still have to be a higher tariff increase to allow for cost of coal. So that's what the regulator will certainly take into account. Just on the impact on inflation, if you take a weighting of electricity in the CPI X basket, an 18% increase in electricity tariff implies a 1.7 percentage point increase in the CPI X inflation rate. So if inflation wouldn't be, let's say, middle of the 7%, then it would be 7.7 as a result of that. But then, in terms of impact on monetary policy, we just remember that the Reserve Bank, in their inflation forecast that drives their decision, they don't assume that there will be a zero increase. They assume that there will be some increase. So the only question is really, to what extent will the increase be higher than what they already assumed in their forecast? And I'm inclined to think that they will be working with a number of anything about 10% targeted in tariffs. So the extent that it's above 10, if you cut it away from, let's say, 13 or 14, then you've got the change match.
I guess, but we were told that the bank inflation rates would welcome at zero.
Studies have been conducted around monetary policy, whether inflation targeting does need to better management of monetary policy. The conclusion is that as long as there is commitment towards containing inflation, whether using a target or using some anchor, you probably end up at the same point. In South Africa, unfortunately, the management of monetary policy has been very poor under a eclectic approach. I'm going to go back there, but we saw how under an eclectic approach the target keeps on shifting. Today is money supply, and then the next day is something else. So, you just need to be clear what you are measuring and what you are targeting. So, the debate is out there. I think that's why Jacques is promoting this dialogue, that we should engage in this dialogue and to come to some conclusivity and how we move forward. But my view around increasing it is really based on an understanding which at the moment on the forecast doesn't help, because the forecast at the moment we all assuming that things are going to come back to the base case, that is we're going to reach a particular level and then the ask can come down due to changing global conditions, due to the impact of interest rates in our case, increases that we've seen since June last year. I think that's a patient scenario, and we can live with that. But there's another one where this thing becomes real, that, you know, the story around food prices become quite structural. That's my argument, so I'm coming from. I'm coming from a sustained structural change around this. And I'm saying, if that's the case, is South Africa going to work towards its ambition of a better life for all? Or do we need to be ambitious? Because if leadership requires thinking out of the box and a long-term vision about who and to be, South Africa does have a long-term vision, a better life for all. And that better life for all means you need to have all your anchors supporting one another towards that better life for all. And I'm not seeing it in South Africa. Whether it's shooting the target or what, I'm seeing things being done systemically to satisfy particular interests. For example, Mr. Mloso asked the issue around the reindustrialization. Unfortunately, a lot of our capacity is old. So if you go to the compound where my director, some of our plants were started in 1910. We're talking about the Kanachem and the Chan plant. 1910. So what we've been doing since then is to modify processes and try to be best practice, or at least to left behind. So this is just one example. Some of you live in country home. If you look across and you see a corn that was planted, those of you who come from Gauteng. So what I'm highlighting to you is that a lot of our industrial capacity has got old technology. Because, you know, we didn't invest in new technology because of the focus on lowering deficit and lowering tariffs, and thinking that, you know, equilibrium will lose cost equilibrium and things will change. And that also didn't change. So the focus there is how do we maximize our capital expenditure of 500 billion rand into new infrastructure and into new technology. Here, Chair, that's where industrial financing becomes quite pivotal. Because I don't think incentives do work. Because from time to time, you try to chase a target, and business, if it suits them, they try to do because of the incentives to do that. So here, a partnership through industrial financing becomes very, very important. And that's where institutions like IDC have to play a role as part of the broader industrial capacity creation, that they work with the private sector, making sure that private sector that could have broken even alone, that through the IDC partnership, those entrepreneurs start making money. Because IDC is an instrument of the state to assist business to create that capacity for our industrial base. And that's where there's still a disjunction there of how the IDC then comes in partnership with entrepreneurs that are using a subsidy. Because the IDC is already there because the resources to a partner. So that has to be split up as to how to locate that, exploiting this 5.3 billion rand investment. On the question of how does a governmental state respond to high food prices and high fuel prices, critically, one of the areas where a governmental state becomes very important is around land ownership. The governmental state will send signals to that tribal land owner, some of whom took the land by force, through an act of parliament, of a government, and say, you've got access to this land up for the next 3 years. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So go back to the state. Thereafter, once the state has got back the land, it distributes the land back, to the people. In our case, then we don't have a government state at the moment, so hopefully we're going to have one. That will really look into giving back the land to black people. Because we know at the moment that the land, a decent portion of the land still belongs to white communities. Some of it was taken legally, the rest of it was taken through forced removal. So that has to be addressed. Therefore, once the local state takes the land back, in areas where it's arable, we create partnerships between the formal agricultural sector and the small emerging farmers through a supply arrangement. There's a good example where the IDC has just done that in the Gat River area, in the Eastern Cape, where established white farmers who are exporting citrus fruit internationally, successfully, and there were black farmers who were trying to do the same, isolated. So what we did is we put together these commercial white farmers and the black emerging farmers to work together with, to supply citrus fruit internationally. It's a project that we're very proud of, and we're trying to copy that model across, even on fresh food. So the developmental state has to really address the land issue, make sure that the partnership between established and emerging farmers to supply for commercial reason and food security for that in our country, so we can succeed. On the fuel side, as you know, the fuel debate is a huge debate in South Africa, because about inland, 50% of our fuel comes locally through a state investment into converting coal and gas to liquid. And the way we've done that is that we've used the crude price as a proxy without looking at the cost of producing gas or coal to liquid. So the public and the state have been subsidizing this entity. And this entity is a huge issue because fuel is becoming a national security issue. And hopefully, a governmental state is going to work with that entity to claim its capability. And thereafter, once that's been done, a governmental state has to come back and say, is the public paying a fair price? Because it costs me so much to produce this thing. Is using a brand crude price a realistic option during the flood? It costs me either less to produce or cost more. So it's a debate that the government has to apply to, because there is an asset in South Africa that's very good at this. It's a global player and it's doing exceptionally well. Chairman, on the ESCOM, I thought I should come in. At last, the South African cabinet has come to the party around alternative energy sources, specifically renewable energy. This is a huge opportunity for us, Chairman, particularly for rural communities and urban communities. You know, a lot of our electricity in our homes goes towards diesel with our consumption, goes towards diesel and other things other than lighting. So therefore, through a policy that the government has adopted, hopefully with energy, with ESCOM raising its tariff, that these options are going to become quite attractive, then we have competition from exploiting fossil fuel into areas that this province is coming to, this province is investing into wind energy. We're working with some companies on biomass, using biomass as a source of energy, although in terms of the output, we should have less. But the policy is out there. However, I would encourage parliamentarians to think bigger than South Africa, to think in terms of our new partnership for Africa's development. Because if we can work very closely together with our Congolese partners, probably we'll be able to have a sustainable future, not only for ourselves and our children, but for our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great- supply us with renewable energy, making sure that the climatic change, the drought that is attacking food production globally, is a thing of the past. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for discussing indeed. No, very interesting indeed. And once again, we want to thank you for your knowledge, your subject, your thoughts. And we'd be happy to have you back on
these discussions. We, when the budget is tabled, we normally have these engagements. I think this would be useful. Also because you've been, you know, we've given us in this agreement that perhaps when we move into the budget it would be useful to, you know, take your argument forward, looking at how far we also have gone, you know, after the statement and then the implementation. Thank you very much. And that brings us to the close of this meeting. There is tea outside. We'll meet again on Wednesday next week, the 7th. That's our next meeting. The committee is not meeting on Tuesday. It's a very bad thing for the committee not to meet on Tuesday. But, on Wednesday, it will be the consideration of the adjustment estimation. That's where we have, that's where we will have the hearings. We will have people appearing for the discussion. Some of the rollovers where we might identify what some of those fees and some. We would just want to be convinced of the committee that this is, we're taking the right decision and approving the adjustment. Okay, thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend.